Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Gray Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. It is Friday, March 18th, 2005, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, after a spot of geek news, we're talking with digital photography expert Uwe Steinmuller. During the second half of the show, we'll be taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org and click on the Geek Contact Us. And I'll give out all that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Geek Sean Cleveland, Technical Marketing Communications Manager from Transmeta. Hi, Sean.
Good morning.
And also Dee Dee Hubbard. Dee Dee, welcome. No. All right, we'll do Dee Dee later, possibly. All right, Sean, before we start our discussion with Uwe Steinmuller about digital photography and the digital photography workflow, let's do a little geek news. You're up.
Yeah, I have the perfect geek gadget for you, Lyle. I think you're going to dig this. So, out of Hanover, Germany, CeBIT happened this last week. Very, very big computer show. IBM, getting out of the PC world, PC business, but still continuing in innovation and chips. They came out with this really neat storage device. Basically, it achieves data densities of more than 1 terabit per square inch.
Wow. That's pretty dense.
This thing can hold 25 DVDs worth of information on the size of a postage stamp. 25 DVDs worth of information.
Who's doing this?
IBM.
Wow.
IBM researchers have called it the millipede because it has thousands of very fine silicon tips that can punch individual bit patterns onto a thin film of polymer.
We've talked about this before when it was earlier when it was in development. So
it's just like the old punch card technology, except on a nanometer level.
Can they erase it?
Yeah. So it works using heat. There's about 4,000 tips within a square. It's about 6.4 millimeters on a side.
So it's got an array of tips as well as...
Yeah, it heats the tips and stamps a pattern into the polymer, and it can erase and rewrite. I don't know what the speed of data is. I mean, it's very, very early
right.
in the process, but I don't know. They hope that they can get it into the next stage within the next 2 years and possibly make it into a product.
That's great. I want to do an update on Nero. We had Nero on a few weeks ago, and they even gave away some of the product. And Nero's a CD and DVD burning software. Pretty well known. I mean, if you've got a Windows machine and you want to burn CDs, you're pretty much using Nero.
I love Nero.
Got a lot of features and stuff. We've been using it for years. Well, they just released Nero for Linux, which is pretty cool. They're letting anybody that has Nero, the full edition on the Windows environment, use it for free on Linux. So I guess that's kind of their test base, if you will.
Oh, okay.
Which is kind of nice. But they're providing software for Linux burning, which is very convenient if you're running Linux operating system, of course.
I have some sad news. Billy Wilson, who is also known as Wicked, Billy Wicked Wilson, he's the guy who founded Voodoo Extreme website. I don't remember if you
remember
that website.
Sure.
I mean, it was when 3D gaming first came in to Vogue 7-8 years ago. he was the first website to start covering it and games. Well, he passed away.
Oh, unexpectedly.
Yeah, 33 years old. Hmm. Died of complications from liver failure.
And Voodoo Extreme is still going. I mean, you can still see the site, correct?
Yeah. He was at a new site. I don't have it here. Something I didn't even know about. But yeah, go
very
to Voodoo Extreme to get more information.
In the gaming world.
That's really sad.
Well, we're going to go ahead and try to go to Dee Dee Hubbard again. Dee Dee, you with us now?
Yeah.
Hey, you got any news for us today?
There's more details about Internet Explorer 7.
Oh, yes,
leaking
yes.
out.
Now, it's so funny because Microsoft said that they weren't going to be doing any more Internet Explorer until their Longhorn, the next operating system, came out, and now they've kind of changed their mind and are doing this in IE7. What do you know about it?
Well, it's, as we've probably said before, it's going to be available to only newer Windows machines, with Windows XP Service Pack 2 customers and Windows Server 2003 Service Pack 1 customers and the new X64 users.
Right.
And it looks like they're going to be adding better ping support and tab browsing.
And that's it?
Well, they might actually try to fix up their cascading style sheets implementation, but
that would
might
be nice.
Wishing for too much.
And you said ping, you meant PNG, the new
yes.
image software. So maybe they'll allow alpha transparency, which basically means a multiple levels of transparency, which makes designing websites and looking at images online much better.
Okay, we
and
can
it's
only
much
hope.
Nicer than GIFs.
Yeah.
You know what's amazing is Microsoft has excellent support for PNG and PowerPoint. That's the secret of PowerPoint, especially if you're working with a template that uses dark backgrounds. What you do is you go in Photoshop and you cut your image out, and then you save it as a .png, so it's transparent. And you can even do drop shadows, and since it supports alpha transparency, you know, which means that...
It just modifies the background.
If you use an animated GIF in PowerPoint, you get the jaggies.
Right, right.
PNG, you don't. It looks beautiful. That's the secret of PowerPoint.
It's so frustrating because of Windows, Mac... the browser, i.e. Browser, you can easily incorporate ActiveX components in there, and the ActiveX support for PNG alpha transparency exists on Windows machines.
That's amazing,
so
but IE
can,
doesn't support
you
it.
You can actually, you can do in IE, you can do a behavior, JavaScript behavior assignment, and make images load as transparent PNGs with alpha levels, but it's very difficult to do it.
Sounds
and it's
like a
not,
lot of work.
It's not compliant, so it's so frustrating that it's all there and they just didn't do it. And so, Dee Dee, the other thing you're looking forward to, hopefully, in IE7 would be better CS support or better CSS.
Cascading style sheets, yeah. Because
that would be nice.
That would be really nice. Then my website would look the same in Firefox and Internet Explorer without all the hassle.
Dee Dee, what's your website?
Querius.com.
All right, Querius.com. That was with a K. Thanks, Dee Dee. Stay with us. Sean, your next news story, man.
Yeah, a German research institute has developed a screen that requires no special glasses to display three-dimensional images.
Nice.
Yeah, it's actually pretty cool. The way this thing works is it's actually was invented, developed by the Fraunhofer Institute of Telecommunications. They're the guys who make the MP3 codec, or at least one of the compression codecs used to make MP3s, one of the better ones, actually. The way this works is, instead of using 3D goggles, the lens in front of the display directs a beam of light towards the left eye and one beam towards the right eye. And a camera above the monitor tracks your eye movements and adjusts the beams accordingly.
So this monitor is good for one person with two eyes.
Yeah, but right. it's basically they're targeting this at architects.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of cool. Let me get some information.
But
it's called the 3D
for architects,
kiosk.
It'd be great because you're able to look at the 3D object as a 3D object. It will actually float in front of you, if you will.
So, yeah. there's not a lot of information.
Well, let me cover
But, of course,
else.
This is all just new technology, and none of it's available yet. So.
Right, of course. How sad. Well, let me talk about something that is probably going to happen from Apple. Apple, of course, makes the iPod, and a lot of people, the MP3 player, a lot of people make accessories for the iPod, transmitters and plugins for your car and all these different things. And to do that, to get a made-for-iPod logo, which is, of course, copyrighted and trademarked and whatever by Apple, you've got to join this, logo program. And basically, you're kind of like a reseller to some degree, even though it's your own product. So it's not uncommon for technologies to be licensed this way and for labeling to be licensed this way. What Apple's suggesting is that they want to do a tax. It looks like they're looking to get a 10% tax on the retail price.
Wow.
So the idea would be, yeah, you can do this, and it's totally free of charge and everything until you sell your product, and then we get a 10% of all your retail sales if our logo's on there. It could make some more revenue for Apple, but it sure is an attack, if you will. That's not snarky. Happened yet. It's kind of in the works. What was that, Dee Dee?
That's kind of snarky.
I guess that's a good term for it.
Maybe it'll make people start producing devices and add-ons for non-iPod products. That'd be kind of cool.
Dee Dee, I'm going to go back to you because I want to get to our guest, and I know we're going to have to say goodbye to you when we do that. So please, you got another news story for the day?
It looks like the next version of OS X is about to go Gold Master, meaning that it should be shipping soon. So people are shooting for mid-April.
Great. So
is that going to cost money?
It sure is. It's going to be an operating system to purchase. But, Dee Dee, you going to buy it?
I'm thinking of renewing my student developer status.
Makes
sense. It's like getting a $30 discount right there.
That's not bad. And that operating system is being known as Tiger, and it's got some great little features.
Spotlight.
Spotlight, which is a searching feature that indexes everything so you can search quickly. It's kind of like a Google for your own machine. And then it's also got some support for new Safari features like RSS feed inside the browser and some great things called desktop widgets. I'm not sure exactly what they're called, but they're JavaScript HTML mixed applications that you can interface with the operating system really quickly and have very light, easy apps that anybody can make. Kind of fun.
More news bit real quick.
Okay, please do.
Just to throw it in there. Doom 3 is coming out on the Mac soon. Although the benchmarks so far aren't so great, but pretty soon everyone's going to be able to start fragging demons again.
Great. Dee Dee, thanks for the update from New York. Appreciate you being on. Goodbye.
Bye.
Well, we're going to stop the news, and thank you, Sean, for having news, and we'll continue with the discussion. Well, we're going to start a discussion with Uwe Steinmuller, digital photography fine art nature photographer and digital photography expert. Uwe is known worldwide as an expert in the raw file format, processing it, an alpha beta tester for many new digital workflow products. Uwe also is a contributing writer for Shutterbug, a very well-known magazine, and he runs OutbackPhoto.com, all one word, OutbackPhoto.com. You can learn a little bit more about him, see some work of his. Just go to today's show, geekspeak.org, and click on today's show. You'll learn a bit about him. And now, Uwe, I welcome you to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, very interested.
Are you hearing me all right, Uwe?
Yeah, it could be louder, but otherwise it's fine.
All right, well, strain your ears because I think that's what we're going to do today. I learned about you. When I took a look at your website last night, I realized I had seen your site before and had seen your work before. Really beautiful stuff. I learned about you, though, more directly from a seminar pamphlet I got from Keeble and Shuckett, which is a very well-known photography store in Palo Alto where I bought my Nikon D70 and where I go for expert advice in photography. Not that we don't have some wonderful stores in closer area in the Monterey Bay area, but Keeble and Shuckett is one that I know. And you're doing a seminar on March 30th about the terminology and stuff that we're talking about today, digital imaging seminar about the managing the digital workflow. So I thought having you on to talk a little bit about the process in dealing with digital photography would be applicable to GeekSpeak and to everybody listening that is interested in photography or fine art. So first I'm going to ask, you started, I'm assuming, as a photographer in traditional film and correct?
Yeah, I work with my wife on photography for now over 30 years, so we did all our share in black and white and even Siebert chrome prints in the traditional darkroom. Mm-hmm. But to be honest, I always hated the chemical part of it. I didn't mind to go into the dark room, but the chemical part of it, I didn't like that much. So in about 1999, we reinvented what we did on the digital side.
What'd you go with for like a camera?
What do you mean?
What did you use for the first digital camera that you got?
There is a first and the first real one. I make the difference.
Let's do the first real one.
When I started, we had Nikon equipment, we had F2s, we have still the F2s, they are somewhere in the closet. And I got in 1999 a Coolpix. The Coolpix is important because, not because I like the camera, from the camera point of view, but it showed that digital was very real. So I wanted a camera which I like from the camera perspective and from the digital perspective, and that, so I jumped on to the bandwagon in 2000, buying a Nikon D1 for today's standard with 2.7 megapixel tiny resolution, but still we have some of our best photos are made with that camera, and yeah, that got it rolling.
Right. Now, are you now, you said that your F2s, your for traditional Nikon bodies, are sitting in a closet somewhere. That means you're not shooting film anymore at all?
No, I didn't shoot any film since 2000.
Wow, that's a long time to be in photography.
The decision going digital was doing it digital and go to the limits of what you can do. We had never the desire, can film be better than digital? Yes, at that time, probably, mm-hmm. but it was not what I wanted to do. I wanted to do it complete digital, complete under my control, and now the discussion is digital better than film is gone, I think.
Mm-hmm.
They are just different.
Yeah.
And what were some of the biggest obstacles that you had to overcome moving from film to, you know, digital?
Yeah. You have to learn Photoshop. So you have a digital imaging or digital work on photos is completely different than anything you do with film. Not in the goal, yeah? But
yeah.
You, and, you know, I learn every day, so it's intensively every day. So this is a lifelong process. It is also with film and printing, so there's no real difference, but it's a different way to think. So you have to, if you don't like Photoshop and working on the computer, digital photography is a problem, except you use it for snapshots.
Do you when you're taking, if you recall when you're taking film shots, are you taking your, when you compose your shots and you're doing your settings of your camera and everything, are you doing it differently than when you did it with film?
Not really. When we work with film, most of the time we used 35 millimeter, but we had also at some point in 1980 we had a Hasselblad or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We always tried to frame 100% so that we didn't need to crop. Although I think this changes recently a little bit. Why not crop if you can? So it's nothing wrong with doing crops. So basically, the only difference is I think, in exposure. You know, with film, we did bracket exposure to be certain one of the slides was correct. With digital, we always monitor the histogram, so the post-exposure histogram, and see whether we think we nailed the shot or not.
Okay, well, since that's one of your first things you have to do when you're in the process, in the workflow of digital photography, is take the actual picture. When you're talking about monitoring the histogram, give me, what is that?
Yeah, the histogram shows you a distribution of, there are two types of histograms. One is just luminosity or brightness histogram, which shows you the distribution from black to white. And if you see lots of data completely pure white, you know you have overexposed and your image is lost. If everything is to the other end, if everything is black, you have a very underexposed thing, which is not too bad, except that you get a lot of noise in your shot.
Uh-huh.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Overexposed is just lost. You cannot have details in the highlights. It's like slide film. When you don't have the details and the highlights, your slide is lost. There's hardly anything you can do.
Right.
If you have it underexposed, you get all this noise, and doesn't look that pretty either.
Right. So you want to get it so that most of your range is your camera's picking up all the color, all the different light in the scene.
Of course, it very much depends on what you shoot, but
right.
What you wanted to get as close to the highlights as possible, but be very sure that you didn't overexpose.
Now, this is assuming that the camera is not on complete auto, because on a complete auto situation, the camera is going to adjust completely to make a histogram that matches in the middle. Is that correct?
No, auto is not really working with in the camera like it reflects the histogram. It reflects what your exposure meter does. That's actually one of the mistakes, I think, in today's cameras. They should have an auto which does kind of pre-evaluation of the scene and then adjusts the shutter speed or aperture to the way that the histogram or the exposure is perfect.
Now, I'm not going to assume that you are really familiar with the kind of the point and click of digital photography. I mean, even the relatively simple cameras now have amazing resolution. Those aren't what you're using. You're normally probably using DSL cameras. So, are you familiar at all if those cameras that most people have when they talk about digital cameras have histogram support in the features of the camera?
Yeah, I think most have. Okay. I'm not really sure whether at the lower end point of shoot they have, but
right.
They have even on some consumer models like histograms, because the advantage of the consumer models is that they actually work live through the sensor while you frame the image.
Right,
so they
right.
can have the data active. In the mirror situation, they have the data after the shot. Actually, this is, I think Canon already announced that they have a next solution where they also have live data in an SLR.
Uh-huh.
This is actually a section where the point and shoot are kind of in front, yeah?
Yeah.
For a live preview. There are many reasons why the SLR, first of all, the SLRs have the mirror or some sort of device. So it's, but mainly the mirror in the way. But this will change. So there will be much more control about exposure in a camera in the future.
All right. So, assuming that you're looking for a camera right now, even a point and shoot digital, make sure that it has histogram support where you can actually see the histogram of the photo once you've taken it, because it will definitely help you get an idea of how much, how the camera's picking up the light that it's just of the shot that it's just taken, and of course, looking at the picture through the display means that you're looking at it through the image sensor, which is very useful, of course, on balancing the shot. But the auto is not necessarily the best way to take a shot. Okay, that's a good little trick. I mean, a lot of what you do, Uwe, and what you're kind of an expert on is the RAW file format. So another thing I suggest when picking out a digital camera is making sure you can shoot in RAW. So let's talk about once you do get your file onto your computer, you transfer it over, and it's a RAW file, why is that more appealing to you than like a TIFF or a JPEG from the camera?
That's a good question. First of all, every picture you ever get starts with RAW. So even if you get a JPEG out of your camera, it just has a RAW converter built into the camera. So why on earth should the built-in limited RAW converter built into your camera be the best way to do the RAW conversion? There's no real reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, sometimes it's very difficult to match it with an external RAW converter. So don't get me wrong, they can be pretty good. So there's a couple of limitations of if you use the camera internal RAW converter. First of all, it supports only 8-bit, which means it clips just a couple of data, which give you more latitude for correction, minor correction for exposure, correction for white balance, and all this. So you have better data to work with. And just for the record, if you use a professional digital back, they all work RAW, period. And only RAW.
Okay.
Yeah?
Let's cover RAW real quick. I'll give my little simple explanation. Basically, the sensors of the camera are three color sensors. There's your primary is basically of light, and in a RAW file, those aren't remixed to make an image that's a mixture of those. They're actually saved to separately, so you can remix them any way you want later. Is that a good explanation of what RAW is?
In a very brief nutshell, maybe. In principle, you have a grayscale sensor with color filters in front of it. So the main thing is to understand that most cameras don't really capture pure colors. So you have to reinvent the color in the RAW converter. which explains, by the way, that two different raw converters with different algorithms will show different colors. And that's one of the headaches for people that they have to work with these raw converters, and they get the colors they want. With a JPEG, they get the colors the manufacturer designed for them.
Mm-hmm. But Photoshop allows you to modify colors on a JPEG afterwards. You can do a lot of stuff with manipulating the contrast and the balance and the saturation after with a JPEG. I mean, people have done this for a long time with Photoshop. So what's the difference in these settings with working on a RAW file versus a JPEG in Photoshop if you know what you're doing?
You have more data latitude so that you don't mess up your data. If you have smooth gradients, they have a better chance to stay smooth in 16-bit. So if you just assume for a second you have a perfect exposure in JPEG, the difference may be very little. But every really interesting shot, most of the interesting shots we do, they don't have perfect exposure. So you could say, oh, why didn't they do that? Because we work in light or situation which are critical. So you want to have a little bit of latitude to change white balance and all this. And once you do that major correction in JPEG, you degrade the image easily.
All right. Thanks. We're going to stay with us. It's time now for people to go ahead and call in and join the show. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. If you have questions or comments, the numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can use the Internet. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. This program is supported by a grant from CruiseIO, providing Internet services including DSL, spam filters, PHP, MySQL. Now with nationwide access, information about CruiseIO membership is available online at cruiseio.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The geek this morning is Sean Cleveland. Our guest is Uwe Steinmüller, a digital photography expert. And we have a question via email from Amsterdam, assuming listening via the Internet. Uwe, our caller asks, or our listener asks, is there a difference in color management on the Mac and a Windows platform, and do you have a preference?
They get closer and closer. I don't have a preference. The reason is I use the PC. This is not because PCs are better than Macs or whatever. I just use a PC, so I have to live with it. The Mac has a much more longer tradition on having proper color management built into the operating system than Windows. But today, I would say it doesn't really matter. You can get proper color management for both platforms with the same quality.
Well, that's good to know. What is your process on a Windows machine? How difficult is it for you to balance your monitor with your output and so on?
I think it's as easy as on the Mac or whatever. I use a hardware calibration. So I use a tool like Greta Macbeth i1 one display, the version 2. And this is just a process. You follow the software. You do whatever the software does from you. It creates two things. One, it creates a calibration, which is kind of changing the appearance on the screen, and then a profile which is used by the color management aware applications.
Like Photoshop or your printing software?
Photoshop or all the raw converters. So I normally don't even touch applications which don't use color management because that drives me nervous.
Okay, so what you're saying is you've got this little piece of hardware, it's like a little sensing eye, and you stick it to your monitor, and then it displays some colors and flashes some colors at you, and then it builds up an idea of how your monitor is displaying information. And then what it does is it creates a modification of your monitor so that you see a little bit more what it thinks you should see when we're talking about color. And
yeah.
However it determines that is kind of interesting because everybody sees things differently. But in any case, it builds that up. And then you get a profile that gets assigned with the image or kind of is used whenever the image is loaded. Is that
No. What I was talking here is the monitor profile. So it has nothing to do with the image. The image is normally you keep it in a so-called working space, and to make it simple, just use Adobe RGB, which is a wide enough working space for most prints to handle.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't want to get in detail because it gets complicated there, but. And you know, the images in that working space and these color-managed applications then map it to the monitor space so that you see what's in that image.
All right. I get you. So it's important to do that, because if you don't do that, you don't know necessarily you're seeing what the actual outcome is going to be. And if you're dealing with opening up files and manipulating their balance and everything, if your monitor's not calibrated, you're not really doing anything effective at all except for making this one-time viewing experience interesting to you.
Exactly.
Okay. What about on the print side? What's the process for you to output a print? Do you take it to some photo printing business, or do you do it yourself?
No, I do all my printing myself. So
why is that?
This is, what do you mean?
Why do you do it all printing yourself? Isn't that kind of expensive to maintain printers and paper and ink and such?
The main reason is, you know, and that's what I love about digital. I have now the control from hitting the shutter to the final print, so there's no one to blame except myself.
Okay.
And nothing wrong with printing services, but, you know, just get an idea. What you see on the screen may be close what is on the print, but a print is a print, and what you see on the screen is slightly different.
Right.
So what you do is you need at least to do your own kind of proof print so that you know what it looks as a print. You want to know how good does it look in 13x19, how good does it look in 8x10.
Right.
So, and you know, printers are cheap enough, except the ink and the paper, so that you can do it yourself.
All right, let's go to a call that's applicable from Carmel. Mary, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hello, what's your question for Uwe?
My name is Mary. I'm a black and white photographer. I'm just switching to digital. And my concern is finding a printer with archival inks that will print archival black and white prints.
Uwe, do you have a suggestion for Mary? For a group?
First of all, we are mainly color photographers, but I love and honestly love black and white. So I deal a lot with black and white. There's actually one printer family from HP out now, which they just have a mold and cartridges for printing pure black and white prints. They have wonderful black and white prints, and the measurements and HP claim it's archival. I cannot tell, because that this is Wilhelm or whatever these institutes would say it's archival. The only downside, there's a model called 8450, and the other model is, that's an A4 printer or letter size printer, and the other one is an 8750, which is just out, not sure in the stores yet.
And what size is that?
This is an A3 printer.
And what is that?
An A3 printer, a little larger.
Yeah, and the only downside I see in the moment is you pay probably a lot for the inks.
Yes, that's right.
The solutions on the Epson side are not bad either, but you need either an image print rip or you go with Quatone rip. You can find a link on my site.
What is that paper?
What
are you speaking of, Quatone rip?
It's a raster imaging processor.
Oh, okay, so you have to rasterize before you send this thing to.
That's a special software which allows you to print metamerism-free black and white so that you get good black and white. The one is a commercial solution, which is quite expensive, but exists for the Epson line of archival printers. And the other is a kind of a shareware solution by Roy Harrington, which is a shareware price of $50, and does an amazing job, too.
And what is the name? Did you say the name again?
You really best go to outbackphoto.com and look at Quatone Rip. I have a whole series on black and white on my site, and you find a link there.
And could you say, I'm on a cell phone,
Simply go to geekspeak.org, geekspeak.org, and click on today's show, and there's a link over to his site, and you can find a lot of information. Clatone Rip is what he's saying, basically black and white processing for the printer. Would you recommend it if someone's, I mean, what would you recommend, well, from a short perspective, for Mary's question, if you had to buy one printer to do archival black and whites, and you've been doing, you know, this is your first time buying digital, what would you go with?
That's a tough question. You have to look whether you want more to work on glossy media or satin media or whether on matte.
Right.
I think these days the Epson printers are clearly the printer of choice if you want to use matte media.
Mm-hmm.
If you want
the Epson, did he say Epson?
If you're dealing with a matte media, he's saying that Epson's clearly the choice.
Yeah, I do matte. I would definitely.
There's your selection solution. Then Epson's definitely the choice. Go to geekspeak.org and click on the. On Uwe's site to learn more about what he's suggesting.
Thank you, Mary, for the call. I'm switching in the moment.
You're switching?
Probably more to satin-like prints, and that's not for sure. Because I think the satin paper gives you kind of a very traditional-like photo look.
All right.
And here the HPs are currently very good.
From Santa Cruz, we have Josh. Josh, you've got a non-photo question, it sounds like. What's your question?
It is a non-photo question. It's a hard drive question.
It's okay. We'll get Sean and myself to answer this, hopefully. Maybe Uwe will be able to help. Go ahead.
Okay, so let's try and get this as concise as possible. I've been having an intermittent problem for, let's say, 2 months, where my computer will shut down on me. And when I reboot it, it says operating system not found. It's not seeing the hard drive.
Okay.
And I've kind of jiggled cables and done things like that to it, and it's worked again. And this time that didn't work, and I actually disassembled everything, took all the cables out, plugged everything back in from scratch, and now it's just not turning
on. I don't want to attack you at all, Josh, but everybody else listening, this is a perfect case. When your hard drive does that the first time, deal with it then.
Well, of course, we all know that.
So now for everybody else, make sure that if you have a situation where your machine boots up and it says no operating system found, you most likely have a hard drive slowly failing. And you can keep going until you get in a situation with Josh. And Josh, we do have a solution for you. But I would highly recommend once you get a failure like that, it's time to get a hard drive. And if you can't do it yourself, take it to a reputable company. There's a lot in Santa Cruz and the Monterey Bay area that can do this kind of work. You can buy your hard drive yourself and kind of work through it. It's not that difficult. But, Sean, you got a suggestion for recovering a hard drive that does this kind of thing?
Can I say one more thing first?
Yeah, Josh, please do.
Now when I plug it into a power source or to a power supply,
mm-hmm.
it will kind of...
Click?
It'll start to whir a little, it'll kind of turn on, turn off. So it's not completely dead, but it's like trying, you know, it's really chugging, trying to work, but it's not staying on long enough to be of much use.
Something that also could be an issue is your power supply.
I plugged it into another computer.
Yeah, okay. Because a lot of times power supplies aren't powerful enough to drive all the hardware in the computer,
right.
And the hard drive's going to suffer. And that can also...
I brought it over to another computer.
Okay, simplest solution for yourself, let go of the data. Just you don't have to worry about it.
How important is this data to you?
I'd certainly like a little bit of it.
Okay, let's say that you really want it bad. Okay, first off, what you do is you just accept that this drive is pretty much toast. Get another drive as soon as you possibly can.
Okay.
So get another drive, get in your machine, install your operating system, get that working, because you're going to want to do this quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So then take that hard drive, and while you're installing your other operating system, take that hard drive, put it in a plastic bag and Ziploc it. Make sure that it has a sealed barrier, if you will. If you've got any of those little things that are like you get in packages sometimes that remove moisture,
mm-hmm.
throw a couple of those into this bag with it.
Right.
Take that thing and put it in your freezer, for 3 or 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you get your machine turned off but ready to boot, okay,
mm-hmm.
and have this case off and unplug it so you don't shock yourself or hurt the
mm-hmm.
hardware,
mm-hmm.
take that thing out of the plastic bag. Be careful because static electricity can happen pretty quickly on plastics.
Uh-huh.
Pull that out, plug it into your system, fire up the machine, and make sure that it's set up as a secondary because now it's going to be a secondary drive.
Yeah.
Fire up your machine, and hopefully for a short period of time this thing will function. If it does, get the data off as quick as possible.
Okay.
If it fails at some point, put it back in the freezer and do the whole process again.
What's the science behind that?
The basic idea is that the electronics, something on the board, is potentially overheating, and it's drawing too much current. And so it's actually causing your hard drive to have problems, or causing your power supply not be able to supply enough current. But if it did supply enough current, the components would burn. So you're hopefully in that state where the electronics are slightly failing, and this will help.
Okay.
It's possible that's not the case at all. And if that's not the case, then another solution that Sean has used a lot is to replace the electronics, the drive electronics.
Yeah, that's only if you have another drive with the exact same type of drive.
Right, so if you've got two drives exactly the same and one of them is working, you can remove the electronics from the actual platter material.
It just comes right off.
Yeah,
remove the screws and it just pops off.
Really?
And you just swap it over to the bad drive, the good board, the electronics
IBM
board.
IBM Jetstar drive.
If you can find another one, that's a good way to go.
You know, it's cheaper that way than sending the drive in to actually get the data pulled off it, which could cost you about $1,000.
Right, and it would have to be the exact same configuration, exact same size.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same drive.
Yeah.
Same model.
And make sure that the drive that you're taking the electronics from, make sure that you have the data off that you need.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
Good luck on that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye.
We have a question for you. Kevin from Santa Cruz emails with a question. Can you comment on the new DNG standard being promoted by Adobe? Uwe Steinmüller, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still with you. Yeah, would need a longer discussion, but let me get started. First of all, I think Adobe did the right step to propose how RAW files could be standardized in all cameras. In the moment, the situation is that every manufacturer is kind of doing whatever he wants, is even sometimes obscuring data so that third-party RAW converter manufacturers have a hard time to figure out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually also an initiative called Open RAW, which deals with that aspect. On the other side, we have now a proposal for a standard or an initiative for a standard like DNG. That doesn't mean the standard is actually already a living standard and everyone is obeying it to it. It's in the moment pretty clear that especially Nikon and Canon have no intention whatsoever, at least publicly, to follow that standard. Mm-hmm. So that may change. And the other thing is that right now, I would be very cautious that people go ahead and say, okay, I throw away my original RAW files and just convert them to DNG, because some of the information in that files will get lost. These are information which are hidden by the manufacturers, which are not open to be read by the DNG converter. It's not a fault by the converter, but it's just not known what these data mean. They may be useful for something.
We could assume, though, in general, that they're not very useful for things. But basically, talking about things like...
No, they are useful. They could be, even, you know, they could be a hint for some optimization technique for getting better imaging results.
Right,
so
right.
It's obviously possible to make good results without these information, but it doesn't mean they are not useful. And so the DNG will be something which we have to follow for a couple of years to come, and some smaller manufacturers like Hasselblad and Leica will have in their next cameras DNG-compliant files. I would like to hear that Canon and Nikon have it. Then we would have a different... Then especially the RAW converter manufacturers could concentrate on just getting better image quality and not so much how do we read all these little formats. And there are strange things going on with some manufacturers that are really intentionally make the life of these RAW converter developers difficult. They just encrypt or whatever they do with some data which are needed for a proper conversion.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so basically, the big guys aren't necessarily taking on this new DNG standard from Adobe, and so this proposed standard, if you will, they're kind of keeping the proprietary, and Adobe does have a converter, and you could convert your RAWs. And the idea behind Adobe's launch is that the RAW file format they're suggesting is that if we have one, then no matter if you know, 10 years from now, if you've got a RAW file and you still want to process it, it's in that format that everybody knows about. It's easy to still use. But if it's in a proprietary system, who knows if Nikon's still making a converter for it? So that's why Adobe's pushing for it. The problem with this converter is that you lose some data that potentially could be very useful in processing the image, though it's not being used right now. So that's kind of the line on it. And it looks like Uwe, you're kind of still keeping an eye on it, but not necessarily fully embracing that will happen.
I embrace the initiative, so okay. I very much applaud Adobe going forward, and it has to be something like this big gorilla software company to do that, because if there's some smaller vendor, no one cares. So I wanted and pushed myself on doing these things for a long time, so it is a clearly right step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's all we want or need is to, we have to learn about that. And there I wait still for answers from other raw converter vendors, because may have a different view on it. But clearly a very positive step. But on the other side, I hear in many reactions, if the new raw converter is not fully DNG compliant, then it's crap. And that's really unfair. You know, this standard is not... It is in the beginning. We have to. It will be improved over time.
Okay.
But it has to get started, and Adobe started it now.
Okay.
That's good.
We're gonna keep going with the topic of digital photography. I'm not gonna take other calls, but Suzanne from Santa Cruz is on the line, and Suzanne, I'm not gonna take your call. Your G4 laptop, which had wine spilled into it, the keyboards are replaceable. You're gonna need to replace the keyboard. You could potentially pull the keyboard out and try to clean it. I had one myself that Coke had been spilled into, and same kind of thing. I actually got it to work a little bit better by popping off keys and trying to clean it out. You can do that too with the older titaniums, if you will, the TI laptops. You can actually pop the keys out. First, what you do is just turn the machine off and pull the keyboard, and then you can start working with it. But I'm not going to take your call. Thanks for calling, though. We are going to go to Bruce in Santa Cruz. An SLR question, Bruce. What's your question?
Yes, I'm an oil painter, and I take photos of my paintings, and I also need to take slides, and I also need to reproduce them on a computer. So I'm wondering, is there a camera that you can do slides and also have the file in the computer, or do I need two cameras?
Oof, can
Does
you
that
answer
make
that?
Sense?
Yeah. Could you repeat the question? I only got part of it. It's about painting reproduction.
Yeah, he's taking photographs of paintings, and he wants to have slides, and so he wants to do it with digital. Is it a possibility? Is that basically your question?
Yeah. Wondering if I need two cameras, or if I can get one of those cameras and one of the, you know, it crosses over to the other medium.
Okay, so, well, first off, you could do traditional photography and just at your processing, when you get the photo processed, ask for a high-res CD of it. And then you're at digital at that point. But you're relying upon your photography skills in traditional medium, and then you can get them on your computer for web publishing or something. But can you go from to slides from a digital camera? Oof.
You can. It's kind of, I always resist to do that, but there are services where you can send in digital files and they create slides from it.
And it's probably expensive.
It's expensive, and it's mainly expensive if they are good.
I wouldn't be surprised, Bruce. Are you looking for these slides for your personal archiving? Or are you looking for these slides to be able to submit to shows? Galleries.
Shows and galleries.
Okay, I think there's going to be a move for show. I mean, though galleries are going to take time, I think there's going to be a move towards submitting a CD.
Right. It feels like it's kind of a transition period.
It is a transition period.
And I'm kind of at the point where I need to buy that camera, so I'm maybe.
I think the best way to go is to still do slides using film, if that's one of your primary focuses.
Right.
You probably already have a film camera, keep it, and then just buy a digital for digital work as well and take two shots. I mean, that's one way to go with it.
All right.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
We got a lot of questions.
Oh, my God, and tons of
email.
Email,
so we'll just go with email now. Sean, you want to take one of these via email?
Yeah. Let me get it to my computer here.
What to pick, huh?
Okay, so we've talked about black and white as far as shooting straight into a camera. We've talked about DNG, so we're answering a lot of these. Okay, so digital photography offers tremendous post-processing flexibility, and we have a listener who says, I note through that people have a tendency to overdo processing, case in point, sharpening. Uwe, can you comment on sharpening digital pictures, and can you over-sharpen?
Oh, yeah, easily, and I actually sell own sharpening tools, but I sometimes feel guilty myself to do that. I give you just a brief story. I just like it. You know, we were in Carmel in one of the finest photo galleries in the world,
And at the walls were Siba chrome prints, and none of these prints was really critical sharp, but all were beautiful. What I want to say with it, this photo being sharp is kind of overrated, and also it shows somehow easily that it's digital. So pull back with the sharpness. You know, you can impress people, but it doesn't really make images better. Yeah, sharpening is a very complicated process because you want to get the impression of sharpness, but not to the extent that the only thing you think about that photo, it's sharp. You should say it has good colors, it has good textures, it has a good composition. You like it. You love it. And the more, the smoother an image is, the more likely you will like it.
Huh. Now, what about pictures for the web in Photoshop doing, when you sharpen, do you actually use a sharp filter or do you use unsharp mask?
Yeah, I use own sharpening filter, so...
Okay.
Which I kind of, on the low level, use unsharp mask. But for the web, I never really dealt that much with it because, for me, sharpening is a goal for prints. And that's sad about the web. The web never shows what the image really looks like on a good print. And that's a pity because I would like to show what it looks like. But these are, on the web, you have small images, and you have to have small images because there's copyright involved and all that, because you don't want that people will just pull off your images and now create wonderful postcards or prints and sell.
Right. All right, Uwe, was there anything else you want to touch on before we call it a show? I want to give you some time, so please.
Because you mentioned on your... on the website that we talk about composition.
Yeah.
And I just want to, was prepared to talk about it.
Yeah.
Because
I'm actually
one who doesn't believe in any rules there.
Okay.
But that's why I want to mention that one of the most important devices in photography are the eyes of the photographer, which means you start looking at the world and what you want to do, not through the camera. You look with your eyes and get curious about things, and then you think, how could I capture that, what made me curious, and put it into a frame and finally to a print? So don't look too much into rules of foreground, middle ground, background, a golden rule or whatever. Yep.
Yep.
The only thing I may say, don't center everything all the time, which I do more often than Bettina, but okay. But the main thing is really open your eyes, look at things, get amazed, and then maybe you try to capture it.
Thank you very much. Grey Wolf Computer Systems has provided grant support of this program. Grey Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliffville Shopping Center in Santa Cruz.
The 2005 NorCal State Boys Gymnastics Championship will be held Saturday and Sunday, March 19th and 20th, starting at 8 a.m. at Santa Cruz High School. For information, call 427-3547. Next time on This American Life, somewhere in the Arabian Sea, life aboard the USS John C. Stennis, an aircraft carrier in the Arabian Sea that supported bombing missions over Afghanistan as part of Operation Enduring Freedom. Only a few dozen people on board actually fly F-18s and F-14s. It takes the rest of the crew, over 5,000 people, to keep them in the air. That's This American Life, Sunday, 10 a.m., right after Car Talk on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
This is KUSP, and you've been listening to Geek Speak. Our guest today was Uwe Steinmiller. He is the owner and operator, if you will, with his wife, Bettina, of OutbackPhoto.com. Uwe Steinmiller started his photography in Germany in 1973. She has a copyright with his wife, Bettina, first exhibited in 1978 in Bremen, Germany, with photos from Venice, he's basically an amazing photographer. I suggest going to his site,
Outbackphoto.com.
Thank you very much. I'm stumbling. And Uwe, I want to thank you very much for being on the show. I'd like to have you back again, maybe in a couple months, to talk a little more about composition and the art of photography. Uwe, thank you very much for joining us on Geek Speak today.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.
The Geeks this morning, earlier in the show for news, was Dee Dee Hubbard. And the entire show with Sean Cleveland. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Thank you all for listening to Geek Speak. To those that have called in, thanks for making Geek Speak what it is. Without you, it would just be us geeking out. Who wants to listen to that? I want to mention a quick mention about my father, Peter Trox, who was a station manager here for years. A year ago yesterday, he passed away, and we're all missing him greatly. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Next week, we'll be back. Geek Speak will be back, talking with people at Make Magazine by O'Reilly. Coming up next is Open Road with Matt Pierce. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP Santa Cruz. I'm Lyle Troxell. Thanks for tuning in.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The presiding judge in the case of a brain-damaged woman in Florida says the feeding tube keeping Terry Schiavo alive can be removed. The decision is the latest in a series of last-minute efforts to determine whether Schiavo's tubes were to be removed by today's deadline. Earlier, congressional Republicans fought to delay the tube removal.